Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we'll be talking about some local impacts of the federal shutdown, including a halt to controlled burns on federal forests in East County, putting us at risk, and uncertainties ahead for recipients of CalFresh, the program formerly known as food stamps. We'll also have an analysis on what PG&E's bankruptcy declaration could mean for ratepayers and fire survivors in California. Next up, we'll have updates on local news, including county supervisors' action to seek locations to temporarily house migrants seeking asylum. They also approved a new park in Alpine and made it easier to build granny flats on your property in unincorporated parts of the county. On Crime Beat, hear how phone store robbers were foiled in Rancho San Diego by an alert citizen. Then on Destination East County, hear about top festivals and events coming up, including theater shows, live music, hawk watching, an open farm day at a camel dairy, and more. Our newsmaker interviews today are with Daniel and Stephanie Bothan, community activists who led a successful community organizing effort to oppose a parole office in La Mesa. The state of California has now withdrawn its plans for the facility in the face of major opposition. Hear Daniel and Stephanie's tips for how to mount an effective community organizing campaign on today's show. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
The federal shutdown has halted controlled burns on 2,000 to 3,000 acres of Cleveland National Forest locally, 10 News reports. Cancellation of these prescribed burns puts all San Diego County residents at risk. The 2003 Cedar Fire, which started in Cleveland National Forest, swiftly burned west into the city of San Diego. That fire scorched over 273,000 acres, burned thousands of homes, and killed 14 people. The president is also reportedly considering taking FEMA funds intended to help victims of other natural disasters to build the border wall, such as hurricanes in Puerto Rico and Texas. Cancellation of controlled burns in federal forests reveals the hypocrisy of the Trump administration, with the announcement made right after President Donald Trump tweeted that he'd ordered FEMA to halt funds for California wildfire victims due to concerns over management of forests on state lands. Trump earlier claimed, without substantiation, that lack of forest clearing on state lands contributed to last year's devastating firestorms, a claim that the state's top fire officials have debunked as false. In fact, the vast majority of California's forests are on federal lands or private property, not state-controlled lands. And last year's worst fires were caused primarily by utility companies' power lines, not lack of forest clearing. But by canceling critical prescribed burns during our short rainy season, the only time such burns are safe to conduct, the Trump administration's actions potentially put all San Diego County residents' lives and safety at risk of firestorms fueled by strong winds, dry conditions, and heavy vegetation as the weather warms up. Cleveland National Forest spans three counties in Southern California, San Diego, Orange, and Riverside. Last year, the Holy Fire started in Cleveland National Forest, charring over 23,000 acres in Riverside and Orange counties, also injuring three firefighters and destroying 18 buildings. Despite the shutdown, firefighters are still positioned for emergency response should a wildfire erupt, Stephen Fillmore, acting fire chief of the Cleveland National Forest, says. The shutdown is now the longest in U.S. history. Trump is adamant that he won't sign any budget that does not contain over $5 billion for a border wall, money that neither a Republican-controlled Congress nor now the Democratic-controlled House have deemed necessary among many competing priorities for funding. Talk of bringing a compromise measure up for a vote, such as a budget that might include some increased border security funds as well as protection for young immigrants under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals or DACA program, has been squelched by Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. McConnell says he won't allow any such measure to be voted on, even if there are enough votes for passage. Meanwhile, as the shutdown drags on with federal workers furloughed and federal contractors also unpaid, Californians living downwind of federal forest lands are now also at risk of being burned.
San Diego County residents who receive CalFresh federal food assistance are getting their February benefits early because of the ongoing partial federal government shutdown. CalFresh is the program, formerly known as food stamps, designated to help people in need with basic nutrition. County officials announced the early issuance of February benefits in mid-January in order to access federal funds that are not available as the federal government shutdown continues. Rick Wan, the county's Health and Human Services Director of Eligibility Operations, says, "We want to make CalFresh recipients aware that these benefits will be showing up early. It's also important for them to understand that these are their February benefits and that there will be no extra or additional benefits distributed in February," he adds. At this point, there's also no guarantee of March benefits if the federal shutdown remains unresolved. Recipients are urged to plan food budgets as best they can to allow for a potential gap in coverage. New applications for benefits will continue to be accepted and processed by the county. Emergency expedited benefits will be available for new recipients who qualify after February 1st, according to the county, but only if Federal Reserve funds are available. If the shutdown is not soon resolved, some hungry residents may be forced to seek other alternatives for food, such as food banks run by churches or other private charities, resources that may also be strained by more people in need. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fisteer.
Pacific Gas and Electric Company, or PG&E, facing enormous potential liabilities for major wildfires in California, has announced that it will file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy at the end of this month. Cal Fire has blamed PG&E power lines and other equipment for causing 17 fires in 2017. The company's equipment is also being investigated as a likely cause of the deadly campfire that killed 86 people and burned nearly 14,000 homes in Butte County last year. The utility was also found criminally liable for the deadly San Bruno gas pipeline explosion back in 2010. The utility provides power for over 15 million ratepayers and has approximately 20,000 employees. PG&E declared bankruptcy once before, back in 2001. Back then, the company blamed its financial problems on the energy crisis, but survived through a reorganization in 2004. Critics blast the utility for putting corporate profits above public safety and fault the California Public Utilities Commission, or PUC, for turning a blind eye to safety risks. Some commissioners, including former PUC President Michael Peavy, have been exposed for having overly cozy relationships with PG&E and other utilities, including backroom dealings with the companies that the agency is supposed to regulate. In 2006, after PG&E was found guilty of felonies, including criminal negligence and obstructing justice in the San Bruno pipeline explosion, the company was punished merely with fines. No corporate officers went to prison, and nobody was held personally responsible. Los Angeles Times columnist Michael Hiltzik predicted before the recent wildfires, even with six criminal convictions on its record, PG&E is almost certain to continue in business as if nothing has changed. That's the consequence of trying to tie wrongdoing to a faceless corporation rather than to the human beings who make crucial decisions that lead to destruction and death. A San Diego Union Tribune editorial lays blame on state regulators, PG&E, and former Governor Jerry Brown for vetoing several regulatory reform bills aimed at holding utilities and the PUC more accountable. The newspaper's editorial board concludes, "It is far past time that the legislature, with the support of new Governor Gavin Newsom, make a similar decision about the PUC. The enabler of PG&E's perfidy must pay for its failed oversight." Bloomberg News speculates that PG&E's bankruptcy may be what California needs for a utility fix. California can now wield power as an entity that will likely have to sign off on any reorganization plan, energy economist Severin Borenstein at the University of California, Berkeley, told Bloomberg. That could spark discussion on how utilities should be structured amid increased wildfire risk and an era of multi-billion-dollar liabilities. Options could include breaking up the utility giant, as was done in the past with other monopolies, or converting the company into government-owned power entities. Talks between PG&E, Newsom, and state legislators failed to yield any bailout for the troubled utility before the bankruptcy declaration. Unlike some past companies that were recipients of massive government bailouts, PG&E's financial troubles are largely due to its own actions, including criminal conduct and negligence in maintaining electrical equipment, not market downturns or other circumstances outside of the company's control. Legislators showed no sympathy for the company's self-induced predicament. Governor Newsom issued a statement indicating that his office has been closely monitoring the impact of PG&E's existing and potential future liability for the deadly wildfires on the victims of the fires and the consumers who rely on PG&E for their electric and gas services. He indicates that his team has been working with stakeholders, including the PUC, PG&E, CAISO, and labor unions. Newsom assured that the immediate focus is on assuring that Californians will have continuous, reliable, and safe electric and gas service, but he added, the company should continue to honor promises made to energy suppliers and to our community. Newsom pledged to work with the legislature and stakeholders to find a solution that ensures consumers will have access to safe, affordable, and reliable service, fire victims are treated fairly, and California can continue to make progress toward our climate goals. San Diegans receive power from San Diego Gas and Electric Company, or SDG&E, not PG&E. But the bankruptcy of PG&E raises the unsettling question, could more utility companies wind up bankrupt from the high cost of wildfire liabilities? If so, will future wildfire victims be shortchanged on options to be compensated for major losses? The PUC denied SDG&E's multiple requests to charge ratepayers for the uninsured portion of its financial losses from the 2007 Witch Rice and Guajita fires, for which state investigators blamed SDG&E equipment. Though substantial, those losses were nowhere near as staggering as the sums for which PG&E may ultimately be held liable. After state regulators denied SDG&E's requests to bill ratepayers for the company's wildfire losses, SDG&E invested heavily in upgrading equipment, fire-hardening lines, stationing an air crane firefighting helicopter here, and installing the largest utility-owned network of weather sensors on its towers across the backcountry. The company has also deployed controversial proactive power outages during high wind conditions to prevent future fires. It begs the question, if the PUC had held PG&E responsible at the first signs of safety violations and maintenance failures, would the company have been incentivized to make safety improvements to its lines? Could the deadly 2017 and 2018 wildfires have been prevented? Now that the company has repeatedly demonstrated blatant disregard for protecting human lives and properties, should it be given a second chance? Or should the state push to have PG&E's responsibilities as a power provider taken away? On the other hand, if the state were to step in and take over power production or distribution, will taxpayers be left footing bills if future fires occur that might have been prevented? These are some of the tough questions that the new governor and legislature will have to address in the coming months. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The San Diego County Board of Supervisors has voted to help a coalition of local nonprofits assist asylum seekers. Supervisors told staff to find county-owned property that could be used on a temporary basis, such as potentially Camp Barrett, a former juvenile detention facility in Campo. The board also established a task force to seek long-term solutions and to solicit federal and state assistance. Any shelter proposal involving county money would need board approval first, as would any additional costs to support services, Times of San Diego reports. Newly elected Supervisor Nathan Fletcher says, "Now, it falls to us to say, as leaders, what can we do? We have the obligation to help." Since last fall, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers have been dropping asylum seekers at bus stations and other public locations in San Diego, with identifying ankle bracelets but no assistance. They are dropped off without any food, water, or blankets, despite cold and rainy winter weather, or even enough money for bus fare to be reunited with family members in other cities. A coalition of nonprofits led by Jewish Family Service of San Diego, the ACLU Foundation of San Diego and Imperial Counties, SCIU Local 221, and the San Diego Organizing Project have provided temporary shelter and meals to over 4,500 people, mostly women and children. Most of the refugees, helped by the ad hoc San Diego Rapid Response Network, are housed for just 24 to 48 hours until travel arrangements can be made. Jewish Family Service CEO Michael Hopkins said, he was pleased with the vote and praised the efforts of Fletcher and Supervisor Greg Cox, but warned that the shelter currently used would not be available after February. Hopkins adds that there's still a long way to go. Supervisors Diane Jacob and Kristen Gaspar voted against providing county property on a temporary basis for asylum seekers. Jacob says the first priority should be housing San Diego County's homeless population. Our priority should be to take care of our own first, Jacob states. We do have a potential health crisis with the refugee situation, but we also have to press hard on the federal government to fix this. But Martha Sullivan, a local advocate for the homeless, calls Supervisor Jacob's stance hypocritical, stating she has consistently refused to do anything meaningful to shelter and care for 9,000 homeless San Diego County residents, which led to the county's worst hepatitis A epidemic in 20 years in 2017. Sullivan adds, with the $2 billion reserve, the county can do both. It's about priorities. San Diego has a long history of helping immigrants, from European refugees to Vietnamese boat people, and more recently Chaldeans from Iraq. David Trulio with the ACLU notes San Diego's rich history of being a welcoming place for people looking for asylum, and said the community must continue to help. Every asylum seeker has the right to humane treatment, Trulio concludes, adding, this is a leadership moment, and San Diego must provide leadership. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is John Fisteer with a Green Scene Report. A huge new park is coming soon to Alpine. The county has announced plans to purchase 98 acres next to Wright's Field along South Grade Road in Alpine. Combined with an adjacent environmental preserve owned by the Back County Land Trust, the new acquisition will give Alpine residents almost 330 acres of open space protected from development. George Barnett with the Back County Land Trust calls the acquisition good news for Alpine, adding, how many towns anywhere have a 330-acre environmental preserve and parkland in their middle? He praised Supervisor Diane Jacob for her legacy of leading efforts to expand parks and open spaces across East County. The county's Parks and Recreation Department advised the Alpine Community Planning Group of the planned acquisition earlier this month. The new parkland is slated for passive uses, such as hiking, riding horses, walking dogs, or stargazing, and could include facilities such as picnic sites, a pavilion, and playground. Separate from this park, the county is also supporting upgrades to playing fields at Joan McQueen Middle School, which could potentially become dual-use sports facilities for both the public and the Alpine Union School District.
In an effort to help provide more affordable housing, county supervisors have voted to spend $11 million on a 5-year trial program to encourage homeowners to build granny flats. The program will waive building permit fees and developer impact fees for homeowners who add granny flats to their properties in unincorporated communities. The vote was 4-0, with Supervisor Greg Cox absent. Board Chairwoman Diane Jacob, who represents East County, says, this is a really big deal. We talk a lot about housing, the need for housing, and the need for affordable housing. This is the easiest and quickest way to get there. The state of California also passed a law that took effect last year to ease restrictions and allow property owners to build more granny flats, which are typically smaller than standard homes. However, the county's program provides a financial incentive by waiving fees for homeowners who build granny flats in unincorporated areas. Supervisors also approved $11 million in funding for the 5-year trial program to offset revenues lost by waiving the permit and development fees. San Diego County's regulations allow granny flats to be built up to 1,200 square feet in size. They can be attached to an existing home or built separate from a full-sized home on the same parcel. They can include kitchens, bathrooms, bedrooms, living areas, and private entrances. Properties must meet all zoning requirements, such as setbacks that meet fire safety and building codes. Granny flats aren't just for aging family members. Although they cannot be sold as individual homes, they can be rented out by homeowners to provide affordable rental housing or used to provide living space for relatives friends, students, the elderly, the disabled, or in-home care providers. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Jonathan Getz with the Crime Beat Report. An alert citizen with a cell phone helped foil a robbery at a phone store in Rancho San Diego on the evening of January 11th. A bystander in a parking lot spotted two young men wearing masks entering the Verizon store on Hamishaw Road, then called 911. The masked robbers pointed a gun at four employees inside the store and demanded cash from the register. According to Sergeant Michael Hettinger, the thieves then forced the employees into a back storeroom, ordered the employees to hand over cash from their wallets, and demanded that the workers open up a safe which contained a large number of phones. But the safe had a built-in delay system, so the suspects had to wait until the delay cycle ended. While they were waiting, sheriff's deputies, who had arrived on the scene, surrounded the outside of the store. After the safe was opened, the robbers ordered the employees to put the phones into bags. The suspects ran out the back door, where a deputy ordered them to surrender. So the suspects ran back into the store and out the front door, where they were met by more deputies and arrested. Deputies recovered the phones and the gun inside the store. A large amount of money recovered from one of the suspects is believed to have also been taken during the robbery. The names of the suspects have not been released because they are both juveniles, ages 16 and 17. No one was injured during the robbery.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Valerie Watts
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This is Miriam Raftery.
And this is Jonathan Getz,
bringing you this week's Destination East County, which includes an art show at the V-Course Museum, Hawk Watch in Ramona, a Lamplighters Theater murder mystery play in La Mesa, bluegrass music at the Alpine Library, and a beer pairing at Baron's Back Room in Alpine.
Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions, including a powwow at Cuyamaca College, the rock band Kiss in concert at San Diego State University, and an open farm day at the Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
The East County Art Association's art show is running now through February 2nd at the Wieghorst Museum in El Cajon. The show features paintings by local artists and runs Tuesdays through Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. More information on the museum is available at wieghorstmuseum.org. That's W-I-E-G-H-O-R-S-T museum.org.
The Wildlife Research Center in Ramona will present Hawk Watch each Saturday in January and February. This year, the event is being held at the Beegent Ranch in Ramona. Guests can arrive at 9:30 a.m. for coffee and donuts before the program starts at 10 a.m. You will meet birds of prey up close in the Ramona grasslands. Charles Scalebrand of Wild Wings, his apprentice Spencer, and fellow falconer Cisco will bring their amazing birds of prey to share with the public. Binoculars, a folding chair, and a jacket are recommended. For details, you can visit wildlife-research.org/hawkwatch.
Lamplighters Theater in La Mesa presents And Then There Were None, based on Agatha Christie's classic murder mystery novel. The play will be presented Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, continuing in late January through February 10th. In this classic whodunit, 10 strangers are invited to an island by a mysterious, absent host. When people start to get killed, one by one, they discover that they are stranded indefinitely. Is one of the guests the killer? The survivors must solve the crimes to stay alive. You can buy tickets or find details at lamplighterslamesa.com.
The Moxie Theater presents Herland on stage from January 20th through February 17th. The Rolling World premiere play is all about growing up, growing old, and rocking out to the beat of your own drum. The lead character, Jean, is not moving into a retirement home. She recruits her best friends, who are also in their 70s, and a high school intern to hatch a bold plan for a utopian alternative. Formerly the domain of a locally famous Bruce Springsteen cover band, Jean's garage becomes the stage for a hilarious story about growing into yourself and getting what you want. The Moxie Theater is located on El Cajon Boulevard just west of La Mesa in San Diego.
Tickets are available at the box office or online at moxietheater.com, and Moxie is spelled M-O-X-I-E.
The San Diego Bluegrass Society presents Full Deck at the Library in Alpine on January 24th from 6 to 7 p.m. It's all part of the San Diego County Library's Acoustic Showcase series. For a full list of acoustic showcase concerts across our region, visit the San Diego County Library website at sdcl.org.
Young Actors Theater will present Songs for a New World January 24th through 27th at the Encore Theater in Spring Valley. Songs for a New World was the first musical from Tony Award winner Jason Robert Brown. The show is a collection of powerful songs that examine life, love, and the choices that we make. The show transports the audience from the deck of a 1492 Spanish sailing ship to a ledge 57 stories above Fifth Avenue in New York. The audience will meet an array of characters ranging from a young man who is determined that basketball is his ticket out of the ghetto to a woman whose dream of marrying rich nabs her the man of her dreams and a soulless marriage. For tickets, you can visit yatsandiego.org.
Barron's Market in Alpine will host a backroom beer pairing on Wednesday, January 30th at 6 p.m. with 100% of proceeds donated to benefit Alpine Schools PTA. As the market transforms its loading dock and stockroom into a local brew speakeasy, guests will sample beers from Refuge Brewery with gourmet bites made from the market's natural ingredients such as chicken tacos with Asian slaw, prosciutto, and arugula pizza, buffalo wings with blue cheese, and dulce de leche dessert. For tickets and details, you can visit barronsmarket.com.
Native American tribes from across the West will be represented at Cuyamaca College's 5th Annual Pow Wow on February 2nd, a public event celebrating American Indian culture with bird singing, gourd dancing, storytelling, and more. Over 2,000 people are expected to attend the Pow Wow, which runs from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., with a grand entry of intertribal dances at noon. A variety of traditional Native American food will be on the menu, including fry bread and Indian tacos, and an abundance of Native American arts and crafts will be on sale. The word powwow derives from an Algonquian term meaning he dreams, and refers to a religious gathering of medicine men and spiritual leaders. The modern-day powwow is rooted in a Pawnee religious ceremony dating to the early 19th century. Southern California powwow tradition includes bird singing, which tells the history of the Native American people. Cuyamaca College's name itself comes from the Kumeyaay phrase, Ekwiamak, which means behind the clouds, above the rains, and the place where the rains come from the heavens. Cuyamaca College is located in the Rancho San Diego community of El Cajon. For more details, you can visit cuyamaca.edu.
One of the best-selling rock bands of all time, Kiss, is embarking on their final tour called One Last Kiss, End of the Road World Tour. On February 7th at 7 p.m., Kiss will be performing at the Viejas Arena at San Diego State University. Known for their elaborate costumes and makeup, as well as songs such as Black Diamond and I Like It Loud, Kiss has sold over 100 million records worldwide. For tickets, visit Ticketmaster.com.
Love is in the air at the Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona, where the next Open Farm Day will be held on February 9th and 10th. Visitors can cuddle with camels, watch an exotic bird show, feed and ride camels, take selfies with camels, and shop for items such as camel soaps and camel wool scarves at the gift shop. Tickets are available at the door or online at cameldairy.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more in the calendar and events section at our website, eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around East County!
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today, my very special guests are Daniel and Stephanie Bothan. We're here to talk about their successful community organizing effort to stop a parole office from opening in La Mesa. Daniel and Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for having us.
Stephanie, tell us how you first learned that a parole office was slated to open in your neighborhood in La Mesa, the base of Mount Helix, right next to the Brigantine Restaurant, close to your home and schools.
I think we're really grateful that the Grossmont Mount Helix Improvement Association, GMIA, was actually able to get a hold of the letter that the California Departments of Correction and Rehabilitation, the CDCR, had sent to La Mesa City Council. And they took that letter and hand-delivered it to the houses that were immediately surrounding the proposed location. And so we live fairly close to the location, and we're very grateful that we were one of the houses that received this particular letter.
So, Daniel, you're parents of young children. What was your reaction when you learned about this?
We knew that if we did not react in a way that would actually create some sort of productivity, some output, that we could possibly lose our home and our neighborhood to a parole office. And we didn't know necessarily what that meant from a qualitative standpoint as far as the kind of people or the parolees or how many. But at that point, we immediately knew that we needed to do something.
Now, you're not just the average homeowners. Tell us a little bit about your background and what made you decide to be the ones to step forward. Because so often we see a project that's controversial, that a lot of people don't want, and everybody sits around and points fingers and says, I hope somebody else will do something.
Both my wife and I could let her speak for herself. We have a consulting background, specifically with the federal government. Additionally, I have a real estate investment background, which proved pretty convenient in this case in looking at the zoning in the municipal code for whether or not this parole office would be compatible with the adjacent or adjoining residential environment.
Yeah. Now, we don't want to be knee-jerk about this. Obviously, these people have served their time, the parolees. Legally, they're entitled to a second chance, and they have to go to their parole office to check in or have the parole officers go to them. But on the other hand, these are hardened criminals coming out of the state prison system. You did some research, I understand, not wanting to sound like NIMBYs, because obviously probably nobody wants a parole office next door to them. But what did you find out that was relevant for this particular location as opposed to anywhere else that they might have chosen?
What we did was we immediately started doing the research that probably a lot of people were thinking about, not necessarily just we didn't want this in my backyard, but whether or not why would this location be suitable for this purpose or this use. And so that caused us to immediately look up. Everything is publicly accessible as far as the zoning map and the La Mesa Municipal Code, specifically chapters 24 and 25. And so we peeled back those layers, sharpened our pencils, did the homework, and immediately got to work on producing a report of not just a comparative analysis of other similar parole offices, but whether or not this specific one would meet the intended use based on its zoning requirements for this location.
Yeah, because the property owner's representative, leasing agent, whatever we call him, he was claiming to the media that he'd talked to the city ahead of time and they were fine with this, that this was a perfectly permissible use. But your research found out that the city staff, I understand, seemed kind of shocked when you went down and talked to them.
Yeah. And we were actually really amazed by the city staff. And we got to sit with Carrie Kuschek, who was more than willing to open up the books and have an honest and frank conversation about his zoning concerns.
So what were the specific zoning concerns from the city's point of view?
To sum it up in two parts was the compatibility of use, and the second part was the intensity of use. If you look at the intent under Chapter 24 in the La Mesa Municipal Code, you'll notice that there's something in there that calls out immediately up front whether or not that the proposed business use would meet the compatibility of the local zoning requirements.
Now, we should say that although this is in a business building, a new office building right along the freeway there at the base of Mount Helix, there's really only a couple of office buildings down there, and everything else around there is homes. It's very dark at night. It's accessible on the one hand by windy streets, and on the other hand, if you were parolee and you needed to use public transit, as I'm sure many of them do, the closest bus stop and the closest trolley stop were each maybe 20 minutes away walking, and that walking route would have taken them right past multiple schools. I mean, we're talking a high percentage of these folks are sexual predators, some of them violent sexual predators. It just seemed very surprising that this didn't appear to have been taken into account by the state.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The nearest transportation, and Stephanie did a lot of the research on the proximity to the bus stops. Maybe she could talk to you about those specific details. But I do know that those folks would actually be coming on and off the parolees for their mandatory required sort of check-ins.
Yeah. What else did you find out, Stephanie?
We looked a lot at, obviously, I mean, you're looking at not just the location. We looked at Google Maps. I mean, most people use Google Maps nowadays. We looked at what were the walking paths they would have to take, not just, okay, you're taking windy roads, but if the CDCR was to argue, well, they could take sidewalks instead. So we looked up, okay, what is the shortest walk using sidewalks, right?
If there aren't any.
there are few, but now you're looking at like over a mile, anywhere between like 1.3 and miles and 1.1 miles a walking distance for people who would be using the same transportation as the over 2,000 high school students and several of the middle school students right around the corner. And after having heard about the particular clientele that this CDCR office would be helping, which is mostly level three, which is life sentence sex offenders, I don't think that that would be a very responsible use to try to help people really rehabilitate. If they have a problem, you know, I mean, it's horrible to say, but like child pornography, if you're walking right next to these children every day, I'm not really sure that would help to rehabilitate someone.
Yeah, good point. And it's also not convenient for the parolees. Let's say you have somebody who's doing the right thing and they've got a job and everything, to have to take the time out to use mass transit and then walk 20 or 30 minutes each way, that just doesn't seem like the best location even for them. And statistics show us that something like two-thirds of these offenders coming out of the state prisons do reoffend, which is a very disturbing number. So once you determine there were really serious problems, threats to the community from this location, let's talk about what you did. How did you utilize social media to rapidly organize really one of the biggest and fastest responses I've seen to a major project of community concern?
So as you hit on, the biggest thing is actually content management and getting the correct or at least as accurate and complete information that we knew to be readily available that included, it was really just in response to the Department of Corrections request for proposal and advertisement. So when we developed the content, we made sure that we provided a consistent message both on Nextdoor and later on Stephanie developed the Facebook page, but we knew that we needed a consistent message and a unified front. And so we created a petition online through change.org. It just, you know, nothing special about that website. It was just, you know, a place for us to get something kind of off the ground and people to be able to get to.
And Stephanie, quickly. How many petition signatures did you get?
I believe we probably have over 2,000, 2,500, I'd say. That's how many I believe we had once we received the letter from the CDCR saying they will not be proceeding forward with leasing this particular space.
You also reached out to teachers and parents and elected officials, and you got the people who were concerned, all those 2,000 or so people that signed the petition. You also published a list of who to contact and who not to contact so that people knew exactly which public officials had jurisdiction over this and how to reach them. So how did that go?
What we actually did was we looked at the original letter that the CDCR had sent to the La Mesa City clerk. And if you look at that at the bottom, it has a list of all of the people who I would assume at this point had some sort of buy-in for writing that letter and saying, okay, we are the decision makers to push forward with this particular facility. The CDCR originally said, here's your, you know, the external affairs office. They kind of use them as a voicemail box. And
that was funny. I mean, it was frustrating and funny. I, you know, full disclosure, I live not right in this neighborhood, but close by. And when I began to research this, you know, you go here if you want to look it up or post a comment and you get it's not going anywhere. I called at one point. I called the name of the guy who was listed as the contact person for the state. the state agency, and nobody had ever heard of this guy before. It was a number for the wrong office, and yet this was being listed as the contact for people to call. So it was ridiculous.
Right. So I had the same issues. I called up in Sacramento. I'm sure you have. I know a lot of people had the same issues. And because of that, I guess if you get me angry, I just kind of start going crazy and looking at lots of information, which is exactly what I did. And I found tons of information. I actually pulled up the CDCR org chart, which is public knowledge. So I pulled up the entire org chart, and Daniel and I cross-referenced that with the letter that they had originally sent. We pulled up all of the information and started contacting as many people as possible, because it is irritating to know that the government would essentially put the people on mute. Right. They're taking us and saying, we're going to put you in this mailbox. We're going to give you a phone number for somebody who doesn't exist. And then we're going to just do whatever we want anyway.
So you also got a lot of media exposure. I know we were reached out to, I think we were probably the first one at East County Magazine to publish a story on this. And the next thing you knew, the TV stations, the UT, everybody else was on it. So there was starting to be a lot of media coverage. You also, as we mentioned, reached out to public officials. Did you have meetings with some of them?
Yeah, the city of La Mesa. So as you know, we had a concerted effort built around Nextdoor in getting a lot of people to physically show themselves and voice their concern at the La Mesa City Council meeting. In addition to that,
how many people showed up at that? I was at that meeting, and it was quite a large number of people, it seemed, were all going up to testify. They were all against this thing. Nobody was for it.
It was literally, yeah, as you mentioned, it was just because of the interest of time. Not everybody had a chance to speak, but I think we selected, again, this goes right in hand with the community, one, showing up, showing they cared, and then secondly, voicing their concerns to the La Mesa City Council. I mean, even myself, I was really overwhelmed with about the turnout, and it was later reported when we did meet with GMIA and the La Mesa City Council, Yvonne Garrett, the city manager, the city attorney, and the city community developer. When we met with all of them, they did mention that it was because of that city council meeting that they got the idea to reach out and ask the hard questions to the CDCR, which later prompted and produced a letter back to the CDCR in response, not necessarily negating or saying that this location wouldn't fit their use, but questioning the intended use based on their La Mesa City Municipal Code.
Yeah, obviously there's some real concerns about parking and character of communities and so forth. We should give a little shout out here. There were a lot of public officials who were contacted. You, to your credit, also published which public officials had jurisdiction over this and how people could reach them, their phone number, their email, their faxes, and I understand those phones were kind of ringing off the hooks at some of these offices. But we should give a little shout out and say which officials were actually responsive, starting with Supervisor Diane Jacob. Although the county has zero jurisdiction over this, she learned about it. She was concerned, and I understand that she's the person who tipped off the Grossmont Mount Helix Improvement Association that started getting the word out to the folks that live around here.
Yeah, I mean, without her, there would have been no notice actually going out. And that is a scary reality that we live in today, that, you know, two parts of the same body are not working together, and that's the state and local government. And in this case, Diane Jacob makes sure that the local community knew about it, despite the fact whether or not she actually had jurisdiction over it. But then again, that information does show it, the local community, where they can actually work together. And it was at that point that we reached out to the local La Mesa City Council.
Right. And then that brings us to Mayor Mark Arapostathis, who happens to be a school teacher in the La Mesa Spring Valley School District. He also does junior theater. And I know he told me after that meeting that he was very concerned and that he was opposed to this, flat out opposed, that this shouldn't be anywhere near school kids. And Dr. Keila Weber, who's the newest member on there on the council, she has a daughter that actually goes to one of the schools that would be impacted, and she told me she was very concerned about it as well. What about the state legislators that you contacted? How did that go?
We didn't actually hear anything from Keila Weber's mom, Shirley Weber, but I'm sure
the assemblywoman, yes,
the assemblywoman,
elected officials, mother.
But I'm pretty sure she got an earful through Keila. The other piece is State Senator Brian Jones, and 2 days into his office, his newly elected term as the state senator, District 38, he hasn't even unpacked his boxes yet in his new office. And we were immediately voicing these concerns. And as their constituents, they were receptive to getting these information packages, I'll call them, where we did the comparative analysis both to the other CDCR parole offices in San Diego to show the square footage and how this, from a zoning requirement, wouldn't even fit them. If they were my own client, I wouldn't recommend this. And from a public standpoint, that against, if you compare this location against to the compatibility and the intensity of use, how it didn't work. And so those were two things that the state senator immediately had conversations when he was up in Sacramento with the director of the Department of Parole Office Operations. His name is Jerry Powers. And you would know that if you, again, like my wife and I,
yeah,
popping open Google and getting that information of the organization.
Yeah. So Senator Jones took a real interest there in, mm-hmm. in trying to stand yeah. up for his constituents' concerns. So after all of this, the state that thought they were just going to go in, plunk some money down, lease this, and you know, have a spot for all these parolees. And by the way, how many parolees did you determine were likely to have been served through this office?
At first, we thought it was around, I want to say 3,000 in total, but what ended up actually being closer to reality based on the estimations and after meeting with the city manager, as well as through GMIA, who had GMIA themselves had a very good connection with other businesses and locals in the community that could actually confirm better details of how many parolees this parole office. It was actually closer to 4,000 to 5,000 new parolees on a recurring basis that would have to be in the local area.
Yeah, that's an awful lot of them. It was, I understand, going to be, depending which set of information you believe, somewhere between a third and a half of all of the state parolees in San Diego County would be going through this office here in La Mesa.
Correct.
So against all of this, the state saw they were up against a well-organized, media-savvy bunch of people here in La Mesa, some qualified, competent community organizers in yourselves, as well as public officials at both the state and local level that were concerned and against this. They saw they were going to have a fight on their hands, in other words.
Yeah, but we also didn't stop. You know, we didn't necessarily get put on the agenda or the docket for the La Mesa City Council meeting, but yet everybody still showed up. And we kind of grouped together through Nextdoor, and we actually almost met on an every night sort of basis over at our home or in, you know, her name is Wendy, very long last name, but she's part of GMIA, and yeah, she opened up her business.
Yeah, you used the public comments portion of the La Mesa City Council meeting because basically the time was so short there really wasn't time to get this agendized, to bring it to your council members' attention, and before they could even get it on an agenda a month or so later, the state announced it was canceling the plans. So how did you feel when you heard that?
Honestly, I think that at first we were very shell-shocked and sort of in disbelief. I kind of felt like we needed to continue, mostly because I wasn't sure if it was really fully over yet. And I still kind of feel like I don't know where this office is going to open.
It was only, what, maybe 3 or 4 weeks after you first learned about this that the state suddenly announced they were giving up. They were pulling out and abandoning this location. What was the reason that they gave?
They said that the main reason, they said that they were confident that the facility would have met their needs, which, yes, sure, I agree. The building could have possibly met their needs, however, not the parking spaces. But due to logistical and functional use issues, they would be pulling out. I tried to call the CDCR, the chief of external affairs actually called me and left a voicemail saying, if you have any questions, please let me know. So I called him back, asked him what exactly were those logistical and functional reasons. However, he was not able to give me that detail, and he wasn't able to point me to the person who could give me that type of detail.
Very interesting. So how did the two of you feel when you heard that basically you won?
I don't know if we won yet. I'm still really shocked. I was really shell-shocked and almost scared at the time. Talking strictly emotionally here, right? I wasn't sure if I could trust that the information was true. And until we know where this location is going to be open, who knows whether it's going to make sense, whether it's really going to be in a place that is well thought out to help the community that it serves, as well as the community that surrounds the parole office that they open.
Right. And we should clarify that the office has to go somewhere in East County, according to the CDCR. And apparently they're losing a lease down in Chula Vista, we understand, or we're hearing that they want to close an office down there. And there's only one other. It's in North County. But the whole goal of coming out here was supposed to be so that it would be a better location to serve all of the East County parolees. So, folks, listen up. If you're not in La Mesa and you're somewhere else in East County, this could be heading to your neighborhood next. Daniel, how might the public or the media, for that matter, find out when the state decides on a new proposed location for this parole office?
We really credit GMIA and the county supervisor for getting that information to us. Without that, we wouldn't have heard anything. But the key here also, and I'm not sure if this is helpful, is being able to understand that everybody really does have the opportunity to play a part in their local community. And it's not about politics or even assuming somebody else will take the reins. It's about just jumping on and doing something productive rather than just ranting or raving on any social media. And so we really took to producing documents, you know, with as much accuracy and completeness as possible.
Yeah. So hopefully when the state comes up with a new plan, maybe they'll have learned something too. Perhaps they'll propose it in an area that has good access to mass transit, where it's maybe in an industrial area, not close to homes or schools, and certainly not, you know, where you have to walk down dark streets with no sidewalks to access it in the wintertime.
Absolutely. And like you said, it's about understanding your community. And this one here is purely residential, almost purely, I should say. But this would have been a complete destruction and chaos to the local community. And I think everybody actually realizes it.
I would say that it's important to be really objective when you come up with your information. We were really great. Daniel and I worked to strategize together and discuss every night, what did we find out? How do we use that? And who and where do we send certain information out to? It's important to be organized and to present a united front and not one of 50,000 voices of just random emotional comments. It needs to be very well organized. If anybody has to deal with something like that, I think that's probably the best information, the best tip that I can give.
Yeah, that's very wise advice. You know, in my many, many years as a journalist out here, I've covered a lot of community opposition to major projects, whether it was Blackwater wanting to build a paramilitary training camp in Potrero, or giant wind farms out in some of the rural areas, or sand mines that the communities in Lakeside and Rancho San Diego are fighting against right now, or major housing projects, you know, whatever it might be. And you're right. When there is a cohesive community voice, and you don't have the circular firing squad where you've got turf wars over who should be in charge and what arguments they should use, that really is counterproductive to stopping a negative project. It's so much more important. We look out here in Rancho San Diego, where they've got a prominent PR guy that lives out there who's their spokesperson. And like you guys, they quickly organized, like, you know, a couple thousand signatures in just a matter of a couple of weeks to show community opposition. That one's still ongoing. We don't know if it'll work or not. But things have changed a lot from 11 years ago when I covered the battle to stop Blackwater. And we didn't have as many social media sites as we have now. A lot of it was walking the community door to door for people. I mean, people cranking out flyers for their neighbors on a Daisy Wheel printer when Blackwater was publishing, you know, 11-page full-color glossy brochures. So, you know, we've really seen, I think, an evolution in that. Daniel, what's the biggest takeaway advice that you would offer to activists in other communities who have a project of concern?
Well, the first thing is to actually look at how does this concern fit within your neighborhood. And we looked at it and we knew immediately that this was not compatible. But looking at it again, you think, oh my gosh, this is going to be an uphill battle. And easily, you almost want to just wave the flag and say, we quit. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
But what we knew was if you're pressed up against the wall, what's the only thing you can do? And that's kind of push back. So that's what we did, but we did it in as much of a constructive way as possible, leveraging, like you said, social media, and also not to discount any face-to-face contact, but even Stephanie went door-to-door to try to rally our neighbors together.
Yeah, so I guess the real answer is that sometimes the activists can win, and it can happen very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And it did happen quickly. And that coalition helped guide the locally elected community officials to act on our behalf. And they did so pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on a very successful community organizing effort. And I want to thank you both for coming on and taking the time today to share your experience, which I think could be valuable to activists everywhere, whatever type of project they're concerned about.
Thank you, Mary.
I'm going to give each of you the last word. Is there anything else that you would like to add for our listeners out there?
I guess not so much for the listeners, but if there is somebody who works at the state and who can influence this, I think that it would be extremely important to spend more time creating and developing requirements to really think about what is the mission of each particular government agency. What does the CDCR do? They work to help rehabilitate people back into society successfully. And I think the one of the largest portions of that is in selecting the correct location. So if somebody works at the state and they can influence this, the best thing that I think you can do is to make sure that DGS and the CDCR come up with correct and very accurate requirements when they are choosing a location for a parole office or any facility that would impact the neighborhood this greatly.
Very good point. And Daniel, I understand that you actually did some of that research and found that there actually are some other alternative locations. It's not like this is the only place they could have proposed.
That's right, yeah. But even within the city of La Mesa, after talking with the community developer, commercial and industrial zoning is pretty limited. We don't like the idea of constantly pushing out further east into El Cajon. But when you look at the Chula Vista Gateway, for example, where the other larger and where this parole office would be actually replacing that one, that Chula Vista Gateway, it has all four intersections are extremely well developed with four lanes on each side of the road. Here in Mount Helix or in La Mesa, we don't even have sidewalks on some of these streets.
Good point.
What I would voice wherever this next parole office goes is for the local community to understand their local zoning, their requirements, and then also not being afraid of their locally elected officials, because they're just people too that live in your area. And I think that was the biggest lesson learned here, is not to be afraid that we are all alone, but that we can actually work together and get something done.
Yeah. Well, very good. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Daniel and Stephanie Bothan, who were the organizers of the successful effort to stop a parole office from opening in La Mesa. I want to thank you both for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region. Please support KNSJ by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Priebel, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.